It's a great privilege this evening to come and speak to you on the 400th anniversary of the Authorised Version, otherwise referred to as the King James Version, although that term is an American term, come over to us from America. We've always referred to it in this country as the Authorised Version, the AV. Well, now then, when we think of the sovereignty of God, we must remember that we cannot understand it. The sovereignty of God and the providence of God is a mystery, but he graciously gives us glimpses of it. And those glimpses I would like to share with you tonight in relation to the construction or translation of the Authorized Version. Now, first of all, I would ask you to imagine yourself to be living in the 16th century. Imagine that it's the year 1590 and you're about 20 years of age and you're meditating because you're concerned about the spiritual state of your country. You're not living in Wales, you're living in England, and you're living in the vicinity of London, and London was a much smaller place in those days than it is now. And as you're meditating, you're reminding yourself of what your grandfather had told you. He had told you of the reign of Queen Anne the First, Queen Mary the First. And she had been a persecutor of Protestants. And you, as a young person, was a Protestant. And your grandfather had told you these stories of ordinary men and women being burnt to death on the Smithfield in London and in the home counties. They were ordinary people. They were cobblers, carpenters, tailors, merchants. They died in a horrific way simply because they believed the truths of the scriptures. And Queen Mary was a Roman Catholic fanatic. Well, you remember these things. And you remember your grandfather saying also how so many people who watched these men and women be burned to death were so impressed by what they said and how they prayed for their persecutors. And your grandfather told you that as a result, many, many people were converted. And then you remember how your father one day came home very excited. He'd bought a book. And the book was by a man called John Fox. And the title of the book was The History of the Martyrs. And he came in quite excited and said to you, "Look, I've got a book that tells you all the stories that your grandfather told you about." Another day went by, and he came in even more excited. He'd bought a book for which he'd been saving for many, many months. It was the Geneva Bible. And he would gather you and your mother and brothers and sisters and the neighbours around and read from the Geneva Bible to them. And you remembered what he said and how he taught you. So you took some comfort from that. Now the reason why you were disturbed was this. Queen Elizabeth I, who was the queen at that time, had incarcerated a very notable person called another Mary, Mary Queen of Scots. She also was a fanatical Roman Catholic. And she had been put in prison by Queen Elizabeth, but it was what Elizabeth called an honourable confinement. And so from her honourable confinement, this woman negotiated with the Catholic powers of Spain, and as a result, and at the instigation of the Pope, plots were made, numerous plots, against the life of Queen Elizabeth. At last, Queen Elizabeth was persuaded by her counsellors to sign the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots. That took place 1587, just 3 years before. You remember, we're thinking that you're living in 1590. 3 years ago, you remember the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots. And the repercussion was immediate war with Spain. And Spain sent the Spanish Armada to conquer England. And in the mercy of God, a terrifying storm arose that scattered those ships all over the Channel and up around the coast of Scotland, and they were all wrecked. So you know, therefore, that forces that were Roman Catholic in power were full of hatred towards England. And your concern was this: who was going to succeed Queen Elizabeth? She'd been on the throne since 1558 and she was unmarried. Who would take her place? And all England was quite disturbed about this. Would there be another invasion from Philip II of Spain? Would there be other Catholic forces? There were many lords in the north of England that were secretly Roman Catholic. So you were a bit uneasy. Well, now then, let's take up the history from that point. I want to draw your attention to five examples of God's sovereignty in this situation. Mary, Queen of Scots, had left behind in Scotland a small boy, 13 months of age. His name was James. He is the James associated with the King James's Bible. So the first indication of God's sovereignty I want to draw your attention to is this: that it was amazing that this boy, James, son of Mary, Queen of Scots, should ever be associated with a translation of the Authorized Version. How did that come about? Well, briefly, the background. Mary, Queen of Scots, became queen in Scotland when she was 1 week old. Her mother was a French aristocrat, very Roman Catholic. The mother, another Mary, by the way, Mary of Guise, member of a very high aristocratic family in France, she sent the young Mary, Queen of Scots, to Paris to be brought up in the French court at 6 years of age. And she was betrothed to the Dauphin, that is, the son of the King of France. So this Mary, Queen of Scots, was surrounded by strong Catholic anti-Protestant influence from her childhood. When she was 17, she married the son of the King of France, who was 16. Very soon after that, the King of France died, and Mary found herself Queen of France, only for a year, for her husband was very sickly, and died when he was 17 years of age. She returned to Scotland. All the aristocratic Roman Catholics in France were hoping that they would now be able to turn Scotland back to Roman Catholicism. Scotland was greatly influenced at that time by John Knox. So that was the situation. When Mary came back, she very soon married her cousin, Lord Darnley. Now the significance of this is this: Mary, Queen of Scots, and her cousin, Lord Darnley, were both great-great-grandchildren of King Henry VII of England. Therefore, they had a direct claim to the English throne, since Elizabeth was unmarried. Roman Catholic, strong Roman Catholic, strong French influence. But as it turned out, when her first child, her only child, James, was born, she had begun an affair with another man, a man called Bothwell. And Bothwell arranged the murder of Darnley, her husband. Within 3 months, she married Bothwell. All Scotland was in an uproar, and they incarcerated her in Scotland and forced her to abdicate in favour of James, her 13-month-old boy. She escaped from that prison in Scotland and escaped to England and sought the protection of Queen Elizabeth, who immediately put her in prison in a nice confinement. Well, what about James? He was brought up now by successive regents. Notice, they were all Protestant. So he was brought up in Scottish Presbyterianism and was familiar with the Geneva Bible. So therefore, wrested out from a Roman Catholic background, plunged as a young child into a Presbyterian Protestant situation. Now, when Queen Elizabeth was dying in January 1603, she turned to her advisor, Sir Richard Cecil, and said, "A king will succeed me. And who should that be but our cousin from Scotland?" And so, of course, an invitation was sent to James to be the successor. All England breathed a sigh of relief, for it meant a succession without war, without trouble. It happened peacefully. Now, this is the James whose name is associated with the Authorised Version. Now, the second indication I want to bring before you of the sovereignty of God is that the decision to produce the Authorised Version appeared to be quite accidental. That's how it would seem. Let me explain. As James the Sixth of Scotland, becoming James the First of England, as he travelled south from Scotland, and he took his time, he was greeted with applause and acclamation everywhere he went. And he gave certain largesses to various people. He created 300 new knights of the realm on his way down. Now, the Puritans in England were hoping that because of James's Presbyterian background, they would have more freedom. Now, when I say the word Puritan, I want you to understand that these were all members of the Church of England. I'm not referring to the few Puritan nonconformists that had come into existence on the eastern side of England. The Church of England had certain people who felt that the Church of England wasn't sufficiently reformed. It still had some of the ceremonies of the Roman Catholics. It still had their clergy dressed in strange garments, all sorts of things that they wanted to be got rid of. So these Puritans met James on his way south, and they presented him with what is known as the Millenary Petition, supposedly signed by 1,000 people. Now, what they requested in this Millenary Petition were 6 things. First, the necessity of a trained preaching ministry of able men, showing you that there wasn't a trained but there were not a sufficient trained evil men in the ministry. The second, the lawfulness of ministers' marriages. You know, the Roman Catholics are taught that celibacy was essential for priests. Thirdly, strict observance of the Lord's Day as a day of rest and prayer. Fourthly, that men be not excommunicated for trifles, and none without consent of his pastor. Fifthly, pluralism to be outlawed, that you shouldn't have a cleric in charge of many parishes, some of whom would never see him. Sixthly, popish ceremonies, garments and terms to be abolished. And I'm quoting, no more popish opinions any more taught or defended. Well, that was the petition. The bishops were greatly disturbed. So when James came to England, in a very short time, the following year, in January, less than 12 months after he arrived, he called the Hampton Court Conference, which lasted for 4 days. On the first day, notice this, James invited bishops only. On the second day, he invited also 4 Puritan representatives. There was much discussion on many matters. There was no question of a new translation, that wasn't on the agenda. But when James realized what the Puritans wanted, that they wanted reform on Presbyterian lines, he was enraged and shouted out, no bishop, no king. If you don't have bishops, before long, you won't allow me to be a king. At that point, John Reynolds, a leading Puritan, put in a request to James that he should agree to a new translation of the Bible, not on the agenda. And James agreed with alacrity. Now, it seemed purely accidental. Why did James agree? Well, he realized that the Puritans had got nothing out of this Hampton Court Conference. And he saw this as an opportunity to pacify them, a sop to pacify the Puritans. Secondly, James had a personal interest. He was quite a knowledgeable person. He has been described as the wisest fool in Christendom. His knowledge was tremendous, but he wasn't able to deal with men. He knew his Bible. He knew his Geneva Bible. He spoke Greek fluently. He had some familiarity with the Hebrew. And while he was in Scotland, the previous year before coming to England, the General Assembly of the Scottish Church had suggested a new translation. And James had agreed. And he himself began to produce a revision of 30 of the metrical psalms, saying that but for his kingly duties, he'd have produced more. So he had a personal interest. But fourthly, he fancied the fame he would have by being associated with a new translation. So it was decided that a new translation takes place. Accidental, we are looking at it from God's point of view. But James laid down 15 strict rules in collaboration with the Archbishop of Canterbury. And the work was to be divided, says James, between 6 companies of scholars. 2 at Oxford, 2 at Cambridge, 2 in Westminster. Remember that in those days, there were only 2 universities in England, Oxford and Cambridge. Now the 2 Oxford companies. The first company was to translate from Isaiah to Malachi, and the second company the Gospels, the Acts and Revelation. The 2 Cambridge companies. The first was to translate 1 Chronicles to the Song of Songs and the Apocrypha. The two Westminster companies, the first was to translate Genesis to 2 Kings and the Epistles. How to proceed? These are James's rules. Every man in each company is to translate some chapters and then confer with the others. When one biblical book is completed, it will be sent to the other companies for consideration. So you can see it was going to take time. Now, who are the men chosen? Not more than 54, said James. But we only have 47 names. Some of them are well known. Others are not even mentioned in the Oxford Book of National Biography. They're unknown to us. These men spoke to one another in Latin. They found it awkward to speak to one another in English. How could such people produce a readable translation in English? But their combined erudition is quite impressive. Among them, there were good Hebrew scholars who were familiar with rabbinical Hebrew as well as biblical Hebrew, Greek, Latin, Aramaic, Arabic, Syriac, Ethiopic, and numerous other modern languages. They even had one who was an architect because he thought he would help them in the translating of the details of the tabernacle and the temple. So they're very knowledgeable. I want you to notice they were chosen for their scholarship, not for their godliness. They're all Calvinist in belief, but they varied considerably in other matters. No one was paid for his work by King James. And so King James commanded the Archbishop of Canterbury to urge the Archbishop of York and the other bishops to grant these men benefices, that is, parishes which were able to pay them more than their present parishes. And these men were not slow to fish for promotion. Did they meet to pray about the work? We do not know. Now the third aspect I want you to consider of the sovereignty of God is that the authorized version was not composed in a vacuum. There were numerous earlier translations that had taken place in the 16th century. And I want to draw your attention to three of these. The first one, the foundational one, was William Tyndale, who in 1526 translated the New Testament from the Greek. Now, William Tyndale was an expert in Greek and in Hebrew. He was also fluent in Latin, Italian, Spanish, French, and German. Also, he had a remarkable gift in choosing simple English to convey accurate meaning. And we are tremendously indebted to William Tyndale. The whole English language is indebted to Tyndale. Notice he had no pattern to follow. Or you may say, Wycliffe had translated the Bible in the 14th century. Yes, but it was a translation of a translation. And that is never satisfactory. So therefore, Tyndale was the first one to translate the New Testament from Greek into English. But he also translated the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, from Hebrew, as well as the book of Jonah. Now, of course, Henry VIII at that time was a staunch Catholic, and he arranged for a secret agent to go out to the continent where Tyndall had to flee. And this man procured Tyndall's martyrdom. What happened? He'd left notes on the Old Testament up to the end of 2 Chronicles. And his secretary, Miles Coverdale, managed to escape and to take these documents with him. And Coverdale completed the translation of the Old Testament, but he himself says that he had no expertise in Greek and Hebrew. And he himself says that he translated the remainder of the Old Testament from 5 other translations. So therefore, that is the first of the important documents available to the authors of the Authorized Version. Now, there were others, but I'll simply draw our attention to this Geneva Bible that I've already mentioned. The New Testament, translated in 1557, and the whole Bible in 1560. This Bible was translated by the scholars who escaped from the persecution of Queen Mary I. They escaped to Zurich and to Geneva. There in Geneva, they came under the teaching of Calvin and others. They profited considerably. Many among them were very, very great scholars and fluent in both Hebrew and Greek. They saw it as being in the sovereignty of God that they were all together in Geneva. And so under the leadership of William Whittingham, they decided to do a translation of the Bible. They took as their basis the Great Bible, which was printed through Cranmer's instigation and King Henry VIII's agreement. Henry in those days had turned court and become a Protestant in name. And Henry VIII made a proclamation that the Great Bible should be placed in every church, in every parish throughout England. It was called Great because of its huge size. It was intended as a Bible on the lectionary in the churches to be read in public. Remember, people were depending on hearing the Bible being read. Not so many could read, so they gathered to listen to it. Now, this Great Bible owed a great deal to Tyndale, but oh, you dare not mention the name of Tyndale. Wasn't he the heretic whom Henry VIII had arranged his murder? So you didn't mention him. So these people, they took this Bible as their base, but owed a great deal to Geneva. And if you compare the Geneva Bible and the Bible of Tyndale and compare it with the Authorized Version, you'll be amazed at the similarity between the three of them. Now, in this translation of the Geneva Bible, this was the first time that the Old Testament from the end of 2 Chronicles, that is from Ezra towards the end, was translated directly from Hebrew into English. It was also the first time for chapters to be divided into verses. Tyndale didn't introduce verses. Tyndale had chapter headings, but then you read it as a whole paragraph. Now you might think about that. You know, when it's chopped up into verses, you may not quite get the run of it because you're looking from verse to verse instead of from paragraph to paragraph. But whatever, it was the Geneva Bible that first introduced verses. But this Geneva Bible contained detailed marginal notes. Now I have at home a photostat copy of the Geneva New Testament of 1602. And all down the side are these notes and along the bottom. And these notes are a quintessence of the teaching of Calvin and others. They're very clear. They make it perfectly clear that you're saved through faith in the Lord Jesus Christ and through his precious blood alone. But some of the notes arouse the anger of King James. For example, I'll just give you one example. Philippians chapter 1, verse 1. Paul and Timotheus, the servants of Jesus Christ, to all the saints in Christ Jesus which are at Philippi, with the bishops and deacons. Now this is the Geneva Bible comment. By the bishops are meant both the pastors, which have the dispensation of the word, and the elders that govern. Bishops being pastors and elders. And every time there's a reference to bishops in the New Testament, this comment reappears. And in that passage in Matthew chapter 18, where you remember Jesus spoke of a dispute between two Christians, they couldn't settle it. And he said, you bring it before the church. Listen to the comment by the Geneva Bible. At that time, the elders had the judgment of church matters in their hands. No hierarchy of bishops or archbishops. Now, let me draw your attention to another Bible. And this is the Bishop's Bible of 1568. You see, the Geneva Bible became very popular in England. It became the People's Bible. And also, because of the notes, it made the Bible understandable to ordinary people who learned to read. Therefore, Puritan influence was increasing in England. And by 1568, Archbishop Parker was getting very concerned. And so he chose 8 bishops to do another translation. But there were no great Hebraists, no great students of Hebrew among those 8 bishops. And so this bishop's Bible was an uneven translation. Parker didn't do his work properly. He did not arrange for the whole translation to be overseen and revised and carefully vetted. Consequently, parts of the bishop's Bible are very good. Parts of it are very poor. Some parts are even stupid. So it was never popular. What about the Geneva Bible? The Geneva Bible, between 1560 and 1611, 120 editions were printed in England. What about the Bishop's Bible? Only 36 editions were produced up to 1611. And New Testament 4 times after that, the last being 1617. So therefore, the question arises, did the translators of the Authorized Version have nothing more to do than to revise these earlier translations? Well, in one sense, yes. For the Authorized Version is a revision. But there was a sprag in the wheel, you see. And the sprag in the wheel was King James. I told you he opposed the Geneva Bible. He hated it. He said it was the worst possible translation, which was completely wrong. And so among his 15 instructions to the translators, listen to this. Number 1, the bishop's Bible to be followed, and as little altered as the original will permit. The bishop's Bible, the most uneven of all the translations. Rule number 3, the old ecclesiastical words to be retained. Church, not congregation. Number six, no marginal notes at all to be affixed. Now, do you see? Those three instructions were a direct attack against the Geneva Bible. Why? Well, as we've seen, he believed in the divine right of kings. He believed that he could appoint bishops. If he appointed bishops, they would support him. But he could have no control over a general assembly as there'd been in Scotland, where representatives of the people through pastors and elders did all the decisions, and where bishops had no jurisdiction. So therefore, for political reasons, he opposed the Geneva Bible. Well, how did the Authorized Version translators respond? Well, they had to base their work on the bishop's Bible. You know, it was the king's command. And Robert Barker, the king's printer, provided 40 unbound copies of the bishop's Bible with wide margins in which in which the translators could write their corrections. And by 1608, the six companies had completed their translation. Now, King James was getting impatient at the slow progress. In addition, there were still problems in England. He knew that the Roman Catholic Church had already translated the New Testament, known as the Reims New Testament, in 1586, and that they were busy translating the Old Testament, which came to light in 1609, 1610. He also knew that the Catholics in England were getting a bit uneasy. And the evidence of that was the gunpowder plot of 1605. So that's the atmosphere. That's the kind of situation in which the Authorized Version translators were working. There was still this fear of Catholic intervention and plots. So since James was now putting pressure upon them, it would appear that they ignored his original rules about sending every single book to every other company for vetting. So what they did, apparently, I think it's not more than six people that they chose, two from each of the three companies, to edit the whole translation. And these six went to the Stationers' Hall in London every day to examine and revise the translation. One of these was a man called John Boyce. He was a remarkable scholar. His father taught him Greek and Hebrew before he went to school. At the age of 6 years of age, he was writing Hebrew. And he was a dreadful note maker. Everything he read, he made notes. He had gone through 60 Greek grammars, made notes on them all. And he made notes of this revision that was taking place in Stationers' Hall. Well, you say, wonderful. I'm afraid not. Because John Boyce was more interested in words than in the decisions that were made. He recorded who said what, and this one suggested this, and that one suggested that. And he was fascinated with the origin of words and where they come from and what is the equivalent in Latin and so on. And almost all his notes were in Latin. But at least he shows us that the translators went through every single verse of the Bible. So they did do a thorough investigation in that way. Now then, a final check was made by two men, Thomas Bilson and Miles Smith. Now, Thomas Bilson is the man who wrote that dedication to King James that you have in the front of your Bibles. I don't know if you've ever read it. Oh, King James, you are the sun that has appeared in our horizon. Oh, you know that you have brought us peace and happiness. Oh, you are the one who attends church regularly, and you have asked for this Bible to be produced. And they laud it in the most sugary language you can think of. But a preface was written, and that doesn't appear in your authorized version. It doesn't appear for many, many, many decades. And that preface is important. And that was written by Miles Smith. It's a long preface in the book of Christian documents that I have. It occupies 19 pages. But it is that very preface which gives us some indication of my fourth point, God's sovereign overruling of King James. So you look to the fact that under the sovereignty of God, King James should be associated at all with it. We've seen, secondly, the decision to produce the AV seemed to be accidental. We've seen, thirdly, there were numerous earlier translations. And now, fourthly, God's sovereign overruling of King James. In his preface, the Miles Smith addresses the Christian reader. Listen to this. Truly, good Christian reader, we never thought from the beginning that we should need to make a new translation, nor yet to make of a bad one a good one, but to make a good one better, or out of many good ones, one principal good one, not justly to be accepted against. That hath been our endeavour, that our mark. Now that statement's important. Out of many good ones, one principal good one. That shows you they did not confine themselves to the Bishop's Bible. Now, King James had put in another rule at the end of his 15 rules, rule number 14. And this is what he said. These translations to be used when they agree better with the text than the Bishop's Bible itself, namely, Tyndale, Matthews, Coverdale's, Whitchurch, Geneva. And he made more use of that statement than King James ever intended. But there's another thing that Miles Smith says that I want to draw attention to. He explained how they, as translators, avoided translating a Greek or Hebrew word by the same English word always. Now, this is the fault of the Revised Version of 1881. The same Greek word is translated by the same English word each occasion, making it a wooden translation. But these didn't do that. And he mocks that idea of using the same English word on each occasion. He says, why should not the word translated purpose, should it never be called intent? Shall the word journeying never be called travelling? Shall the word think never be called suppose? Shall the word pain never be called ache? Shall the word joy never be called gladness? Now that's the influence of Tyndale. That's the influence of Tyndale. Tyndale used good Saxon English. His words are short. His words are understandable. Tyndale didn't believe in using street English, but he used English that is a notch above that. He used English that the ordinary boy who drives the plough could understand. Now then, it's quite miraculous, the influence of Tyndale on the Authorised Version. Computer studies have shown that 83% of the words of the New Testament in the Authorised Version are from Tyndale. And 75% of the words of the Old Testament, as far as he translated it, are also from Tyndale. That's quite surprising. There you see the overruling of King James. And you find exactly the same thing in the Geneva Bible as well. Now, you know, there are places where the authorized version was not translated as well as in Tyndale. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Though I speak of the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so I can remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. That word charity has given people misconceptions. It has meant that many people have interpreted, as long as I do good, I'm all right. How did Tyndale translate it? Listen to this. Now this is the English of 1526. And I think you'll understand it. Though I speak with the tongues of men and angels, and yet had no love, I were even as sounding brass and as a tinkling cymbal. And though I could prophesy and understood all secrets and all knowledge, yea, if I had all faith, so that I could move mountains out of their places, and yet had no love, I were nothing. And though I bestowed all